Looks quite an age since we met here last. So often, due to various reasons, our meetings have had to be postponed. So many things have happened since we met here last. And before resuming the thread of our studies in the synthesis, the yoga of knowledge particularly, I thought it would be of interest to you to know what I have been doing, especially in certain spheres which have a relevance. To the life of all of us who are gathered here. All these 3 decades I have confined myself to life in the ashram, the yoga practice, studies, work, service, and very little of outside contacts. However, it is only during the last 1 year or so that there were indications, both from within and without, that a change was coming and I had to be prepared for it. It was in the course of this movement that a few months ago a publicist from the town approached me. He came into my life in a very funny way. I had known his name all these years, at least 15, 20 years, and I was told that he is a very evil man. And I never met him, had never seen him even. But during the last 1 year, I had occasion to read his poems. He writes a poem per week in his journal. And it occurred to me that a person with an evil in him could never write those poems. Because each time I read them, they touched certain levels in my being that I started feeling a certain affinity. And when some of those poems were collected in book form, he approached me whether I would be willing to preside over a function releasing the book to the public and also inaugurate the book. I found it significant that he should have approached me, whom he didn't know. So I did go associate myself with the book. Thereafter, he started coming to me, asking if I could help him in understanding certain portions in the Bible, he's a Christian, which had been some sort of problems to his rational understanding. I did my bit in the light of Sri Aurobindo's and Mother's teachings. And when I explained to him, he found it very natural. That way the contact increased. Till about 3 months ago or 4 months ago, he asked me if I would start along with him an inter-spiritual fellowship, inter-religious fellowship. I told him yes, but the name should be changed from inter-religious to inter-spiritual. And I explained to him how the age of religions is over. Religions have done their part, and it is the spiritual age that is dawning. Then someone objected that spirituality is all one, and how could there be interspiritual? Well, I had to explain, again, from the background of Sri Aurobindo's thought and vision, that though the spirit is one, the experience it lends itself to is various. One can realize the spirit not only at different levels of the being. This will have relevance to this theme that we'll have to consider later. One can realize the spirit not only at different levels of the being, but vision it in different forms. There is, I had to explain, the old spirituality, which is world-negating, ascetic spirituality. There is the aesthetic spirituality, which regards the divine in the form of beauty, form of harmony. There is the spirituality which takes the line of knowledge, another of love, and so on. There are any number of types of spirituality, depending upon the types and temperaments of nature. And what had happened in religions is happening even in the field of spirituality. That is rivalry. Each group claims monopoly for truth, claims superiority. Condemns or deprecates the others. A time has come, if the spiritual age is to be expedited, when we must find the meeting ground. We must recognize that basically all the approaches to the spirit, all the manifestations to the spirit, are based on one being, one consciousness, one in essence, though diverse in manifestation. This was accepted, and quite a group from different walks of life in the city gathered. Originally, they were a bit suspicious whether this was one more attempt by the ashram to make inroads in the cultural and the deeper life of the people. After a certain time, their minds were disabused of these fears, and things went on progressing. We took up, for instance, certain problems to be discussed from various points of view, the problems that vex not only the Indian community in India, but even in Pondicherry. Say, for instance, the problem of corruption. Well, we discussed from the spiritual point of view the maladies, the causes, discussed the remedies. And it was when I was formulating the solution to this universal evil of corruption that it dawned on me with a certain impact that the one solution is the universal man. It looks so evident that the next step for common humanity is that of universal man. Both Sri Aurobindo and the mother have said repeatedly that unless one eliminates ego from one's consciousness, one breaks out of one's own walls of separative individuality, extends his consciousness, expands his being to embrace as large a portion of humanity as possible, it is vain to expect the supramental consciousness to dwell in him. And as you all know, the common man, humanity, is not yet ready to accept and practice, they may mentally accept, but to practice the way that leads directly to the supramental perfection. There is an intermediate state, the stage of the universal man, the universalization of consciousness, the blossoming of the cosmic consciousness that has to be gone through. And I felt, if that is put in terms that an ordinary intellectual or a developed man, cultivated man can understand, that could be not only the meeting ground but the stepping ground for the further evolution. I proposed it, I discussed this with a few of my colleagues in the fellowship, and they warmly welcomed the idea. It was pointed out to them that the universal man is not confined to the spiritual dimension of life, but in the field of economics, polity, sociology, education, in every aspect of life, unless man takes steps to broaden himself, takes a large view, takes steps to universalize his outlook, his inlook, and his consciousness, there can be no lasting solution to the problem. Unless I can feel the problems of my neighbor as my own, the best in me will not come forward to solve them. So the project of universal man is being put through certain preparatory forms. We have split up into three or four committees, one dealing with social reconstruction towards the universal man, education towards the universal man, science and technology towards the universal man, and work as worship towards the universal man. So I have been rather busy in this work. Often I have been asked, why shouldn't you bring friends from Oroville who have gathered here precisely for this large vision, to realize this large vision? I have told them that they will come in the right time. But I thought you should know that side by side with the life that we are leading here, building up Oroville, we have to keep our ears tuned and eyes focused on what is going on around us. It is the winds from Oroville that have created an atmosphere suitable to the emergence of the universal man. And all of you should have a thought that this idea of universal man should germinate and sprout in the consciousness of all others who are not formally committed to the ideal or the teaching of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. They also have a claim on truth. Humanity includes many sections. Whatever they may think, we can't afford to limit ourselves to those who accept this so-called ideology. We have to be broad, large in our hearts, and as I had occasion to say in the final session of the World Union Conference the other day, we who have received so much from the spiritual gifts of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother are anxious to share the bounty with the world at large. And in the process, we are prepared to assimilate what the world has got to offer to us. So this is the stage where the project of universal man stands, and I expect early next month it will be formally inaugurated in the city. Then will be the time for those of you who agree with the principles, with the programs which will be published, to identify yourself, at least in your mind, and add your moral and spiritual weight on the side of that movement. Further, third, as you are all aware, we had the World Conference of the World Union last week. It was the fourth such conference held during the last 15 years of the existence of the World Union. Its theme was World Unity, Concept and Practice. This in turn was split up into four groups, study groups. Each committee devoting itself for an examination in depth of the content of world unity, of the ways and means to achieve world unity, the type of education that promotes world unity, and the manner in which all sections of society could be involved and made to participate in this world union movement. All the committees were at work for 3 days, and as our friend Cyril would tell you, the discussions were quite fruitful, and the papers produced by each of the committees were excellent. An integrated statement was made and presented on the last day, which will appear in the next issue of the World Union Journal, which will give a coverage of the entire conference. I had occasion, while summing up the proceedings and the recommendations, to put forward Auroville as the pilot project for the realization, the immediate realization of world unity. I had the privilege to point out to them that here is a miniature world, both externally and internally. And I asked each one who had gathered there, in order to participate in the world union movement, that they should play some part in whichever way that is given to each one in the building of Auroville. Auroville, not a city of buildings, not a city of numbers, but a unique city of consciousnesses. I don't say consciousness, because there will be gradations of consciousness, representing the different levels of consciousness that humanity has arrived in its evolution on earth. It was warmly accepted, and I do look forward to a very fruitful association between the members of the World Union, not only in Pondicherry but outside, and Auroville. This will give an idea of the work that has been in certain ways responsible for the interruption of our classes and, of course, there was what happened on the 17th of November, subsequent developments. I did have occasion to come there and speak to you, and it comforts me that my efforts to present the situation as experienced by my consciousness has been found useful by a large number of devotees and well-wishers. I have already sent some copies of the service letter, which includes a report of this talk, as also some correspondence that I had both with friends in India and abroad on this subject. Before I resume discussion on the subject of Gnosis and Ananda, if any friends here have any questions to ask, I would like to deal with them now rather than at the end. There is no politics in this movement at all, though polity, the science of the organization of human society from the point of view of an ideal polity, can form a part of the general perspective. Politics is far from the interests of this movement. Our aim is to create a climate of oneness, of universality, where in which it will be difficult for corruption, chicanery, and such things to survive in polity. Politics has to be not rejected but uplifted. Politics has to be made into statesmanship. Far from serving individual interests of a few politicians, the setup, the organization, has to be pressed into service for the good of the total community. Sri Aurobindo has written, 1/4 of the defense of Indian culture, what is now issued as the foundations of Indian culture, to this subject. And he discusses what an important role a healthy polity can play in the evolution of the collectivity. This movement that I refer to aims at relating spiritual enlightenment, spiritual consciousness, to the problems of the collectivity, life active problems of the collectivity in society, problems in education. You are seeing how many strikes, how many lockouts in factories, how many cases of corruption, Watergate, and there are 1,000 Watergates in India, people don't know yet. All these, they can't be tackled piecemeal. The approach of a spiritual man has to be on the fundamentals, at the roots. If a malady is tackled at its roots, it has to go. What others are doing at present is to treat the symptoms. A correct diagnosis has to be made, followed up with elimination at its roots. Whether people accept what you say immediately or not, we have to go on dinning into the ears that this is the truth, this is the truth. Some will awaken, some awaken. Some admit, they don't express, but they realize that is again. We intend there to associate. We are not going to function as a group of spiritual people. Spiritual people in collaboration with the authorities in different fields, principals, professors, student representatives, administrators, parents, for instance in the field of education. Their representatives will be roped in, things explained to them, their cooperation, so they will be made to work. We are not going into the field, our field is different. But we have to put pressure, show them the way. Similarly, adulteration, black marketing, social evils, political evils. Pondicherry is an ideal state, an ideal place, where it is a small place, people are, the rank and file are still sound, not corrupted. A few politicians, they still can be managed. Once they are convinced that we have no private axe to grind, they do respect. This is a place, 50 years of earthly existence by Sri Aurobindo and the mother has not gone in vain. When the Prime Minister, late Prime Minister Pandit Nehru came to Pondicherry, he announced at a public meeting, I have travelled so many places in India, but there is a peculiar peace in Pondicherry. And Pondicherry, he complimented the Pondicherry people on the peace. He did not know. From where the peace came. I had seen when he met mother at 11 o'clock in the morning, mother giving to him a peace flower, which mother herself put it there. I know from where the peace came. So this, their consciousness, their vibrations have permeated the whole of Pondicherry. There is a meaning why Auroville should be here. I have been asked so many times, why is it, if Auroville has a universal significance, a cosmic significance, why should it be located in Pondicherry, in this corner, God-forsaken place, where there is no water, no electricity, nothing, why do you want it there? Well, this is the truth. Physically, this place has been prepared. Why God chose this place, it's not, we can't question Him. It is that. Why Sri Aurobindo had to come here? Mother once said that I never liked the sea. If it was given to me, I would have chosen the mountains. But Sri Aurobindo chose the sea, I have to come to the sea. Mother did say it. And all of us have come not because we are fond of... Today Pondicherry is livable. You have no idea what it was 30 years ago when I came. Early in the morning at 8 o'clock I was sweating, like 12 o'clock today. And at that time mother had said, as the descent takes place, you will find a change even in the physical climate. Pondicherry will get less hot. And I have been seeing it decade by decade. Today Pondicherry is ideal. There is not too much rain. The winter is bearable. The summer is comfortable. Of course, for you people from the colder countries, it is baking. But for us, we know what we have gone through. So there is, in Pondicherry, even a physical climate seeped with the spiritual and the finer vibrations of harmony conducive to a wider fluorescence. of the divine manifestation. Shall we proceed now? It is a difficult chapter. We came up to the gnosis, described the various levels that the seeker has to ascend before he arrives at the gnosis. The chapter that we are dealing with discusses that the gnosis is not the end. The supramental world, the plane, is not the terminus. It is, as we discussed and understood, a link world between the higher hemisphere and the lower hemisphere of matter, life and mind. Once you go into the gnosis, the level of the gnosis, once you go into the gnosis, the level of the gnosis, there is a complete reversal of consciousness. You arrive at what is called the transcendent, over the terrestrial universe. But we have to remember that though the divine consciousness, the Satchidananda, is there situated in the higher hemisphere on its own, it is involved on every plane of creation. That is why it is possible to realize the divine, to realize the divine bliss, ananda, on any plane that we choose. It is possible to realize by concentrating purely on the physical plane, because in matter too is the spirit. There is a line of yoga in which you probe into the physical body. You scrutinize and intensify your search into matter. Make it subtle and subtle, your experience of it. And the body, the physical being, goes into a kind of sleep of self-concentration, or it merges into the self, capital self, that presides over the physical level, within or without. In either case, there is the reflection of the Satchidananda, the ananda aspect, in matter. Thereby, one experiences a certain kind of liberation. One behaves like a child of God. The mind is not cared for. The other aspects are left out. It is only on the physical level. One feels as a child feels. One feels, one acts as one feels, irresponsibly from our point of view. But there he acts in freedom. This is the kind of liberation that many of you have either seen or read of in India. It is called the physical realization, realization of God in the physical. You will find many sannyasins, godmen, lying on anthills, forests, here and there, look so crude, so dirty, but there is a light in their eyes, there is a love in their heart. People go. They may throw a stone at you, but that stone will cure your disease if you go to them for cure. There are similarly possibilities of realizing the divine bliss on the level of life. What Bergson called élan vital, the moving, the dynamic vital, one concentrates there, looks upon that life as divine, and arrives at a point by yoga, appropriate yoga, by which the divine is reflected in the currents of life force. One merges into the self of the life plane, within and without. Thereby, one is liberated into a kind of freedom, which throws off the yoke both of the mind and the body. And there is what Sri Aurobindo describes as the dizzy dance of life. You will find him shattering to pieces all your conventions. He will achieve, he will express what he has gained in a wild abandon. Similarly, it is possible to realize the divine on the level of the mind. One realizes him in thought, in idea, in a certain detachment, rejects life as belonging to a passing moment. One takes stand in the witness poise, merges in the self behind, and has always a consciousness that is separate, that is in union with the divinity that presides, that witnesses. Such a person is aloof, a hermit, a sage, a contemplative seer. Above, in the mind itself, there are various levels. Possible to realize the divine in the thought mind, higher illumined mind, and so on, till you come to the level of the Gnosis. And this you should know, that no other philosophy in the world explains. Each philosophy presents its own approach to the divine and says this and nothing else. This integral philosophy is the only one of its kind which gives due weight to every approach, to every possibility of realizing the divine on every level, condemns none, but shows the place of each in the rising tiers of creation, of manifestation, and weaves them into a pattern of rising perfection. One arrives at the Gnosis, the supramental, or the knowledge will, consciousness. There also, one realizes the divine bliss as a concomitant of the Gnostic state. The individuality of the seeker, or the being who crosses into this belt, is not what it was in the lower hemisphere. It is a point, it is a center for the radiation, for the flow of the divine consciousness. The soul is not separate from its nature as in the terrestrial field. terrestrial belt, but arrives at a certain biune poise with its nature. The Lord and the Spouse, Ishwara and the Shakti, one and yet two in functioning, one in essence, but two in functioning, in manifestation. This is the state at which the soul arrives. There is a unity, there is a union of two, but a polarity, in the a necessary polarity in manifestation. But this is not the end. Here, the emphasis is still on the knowledge, will aspect of the Divine. It is only the other side that is replete with bliss. As one of the oldest Upanishads describes, there is the self of food, by which they mean the material self. Indwelling that material self is the self of life, what they call the Purusha. Indwelling this life self is the mental self, mind self. Indwelling the mind self is the knowledge self. And indwelling the knowledge self, the soul of all the selves, is the self of bliss. It is at the creative root of all life. That is why the world of Ananda is described in the Veda as the world of birth, giving birth to whole creation, the source, the fountain. When, in the course of spiritual development, the soul crosses from the Gnostic into the bliss world, all becomes subsidiary. Knowledge, power, movement, all these become various formulations of an overwhelming bliss. They become particular scintillations of an underlying, it is no more underlying, of an overflowing bliss, ananda. Sri Aurobindo points out here how, when a man arrives at this level, even the desire, even the aspiration for liberation falls off. He traces how the Divine Creator draws man to himself through various lures. The first lure is the lure of material comfort, physical comfort, the prizes of mind, the prizes of life force, which man can earn and enjoy on earth by turning to God, by praying to God, by invoking the grace of God. Next, for more developed people, there are the lures of heaven. Eternal joy, eternal happiness, undying light, these are present. Later, even these pearl, and there is what Sri Aurobindo calls a very subtle lure, the lure of nirvana, the lure of escape. All is to be rejected, and I merge in an undisturbable, immutable silence or a bliss. Sri Aurobindo points out that even this lure of wanting to escape, of wanting to be liberated, falls off when one touches the world of bliss. For, as another Upanishad points out, when one realizes the cosmic or the supra-cosmic ananda, what is there to fear? It is only when the mind is still ignorant, when the mind is still removed 1 inch, 1 centimeter from the bliss, from the unity with the divine, that there is fear. When one merges into the divine Brahman, who is spread all over, there is no second. Fear can come only when there is another. So with the elimination of the disease of falsehood, the ills of falsehood also go. There is neither the desire nor the striving after liberation. All becomes a movement of the divine. One is no more afraid to descend from that level into this world of ignorance and suffering. Ignorance and suffering have different values. They make a different impact for a man established in the Ananda consciousness. One reacts differently. To him, there is no hesitation. There is, whether he descends or whether he accepts the ascending soul, he participates freely, without bounds, in the divine movement of manifestation. This is the acme for the present cycle of evolution. More there may be and there could be, because there can be no boundaries, no finish, no final in the infinite. But what is intended for man in the, his present cycle of evolution, the final term is this summum bonum of bliss. Question? Loretta? No. Before bliss you have no question. Do we meet next Sunday? This is what you say. I think next Sunday the theme is more interesting. It will be higher knowledge and lower knowledge. Less philosophical, I mean. More attainable, more attainable. Yes. It is in the Taittiriya Upanishad. Taittiriya, it is in Shrivindos 8 Upanishads. Taittiriya, TaittiRiya. I think it is the last but one in the 8 Upanishads. And in the third section, last third part, it is described from Ananda all things are born, in Ananda they live, and in living they depart into Ananda. Goswami. Then in the Vedas, it is not called the world of bliss, it is called the world of birth, Janaloka. They, in the Veda, you know, they speak of the worlds from the top of existence, consciousness, birth, not bliss, jana. And then the world of light, the vast world of light, the world of mind, the world of life, the world of food or physical matter. And the whole conception of Indian positive philosophy is that the whole world exists because of this undercurrent of bliss. If there was not this underlying bliss, there could not be the will to live. In spite of all odds, man wants to live. Somewhere in the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo remarks that after all is said and done, the sum total of happiness is more than the sum total of suffering.
And that is why man wants to live. Barring aberrations, occasional aberrations like suicides, man doesn't want to die. He wants to live. There is underlying every experience a stream of delight. That is the delight which the Creator continuously draws from His creation, and which you and I, as replicas or images of the Creator, are intended to draw. It is to draw your attention to this aspect and this possibility that aesthesis, the science of aesthesis, concentrates in drama, plays, poetry, epics, in describing situations, you know, which are outwardly painful, produce suffering, show suffering. But there is something in you which draws the sap of delight in it, which you want to sit and see. You may shed tears, but they are tears of some relishment. That is because behind even pain and pleasure, they are all imperfect values of an underlying bliss. In Indian Sanskrit literature, there are as many as 9 sentiments, they call, 9 forms: heroism, love, laughter, fear, disgust. All these, there are 8 or 9 of them, branchings of the underlying delight of life, which has to be drawn. The more cultivated a man is, the more he is able to draw the sap of delight from all experiences, even from experiences which seem contrary to an undeveloped being. That is why the creative principle is delight. The Lord came out in an ebullition of delight. The delight of creation, the delight of manifesting Himself in conditions which are the very opposite of His own, that is the vajra which the Divine took against Himself. In the last chapter of the Riddle of the World, in answer to a French questioner, Sri Aurobindo describes how this idea could have come. All is bliss, all is full plenary consciousness, there is great delight. But a shadow came, an idea came, possibly, supposing there is no consciousness, there is no consciousness, there is apparently no existence, there is no delight. How can I manifest that? The Divine took the challenge. The idea came, and the idea meant the possibility. To realize the possibility, the whole creation started. 1,000,000 sparks went out of Him. There, all of us, we are the souls, we are the sparks who are laboring for Him. And we are today in the mid-stage of this evolution, which is climbing back to the source of delight, to establishing that it is possible for the Divine to manifest Himself in conditions that are totally opposite to the conditions there. And naturally, it is not just out of caprice to convince Himself, no. A consciousness which has issued from the Supreme, has done all these circles, gathered all this experience and goes back, will be far richer in content than the original consciousness that came up. In that sense, man is greater than God, potentially.
Could not find its soul in all that was. It drew itself into a living spot. So you point out to this?
Yes. You see, it depends upon how you look at it. The phenomenon, the thing is the same. The movement is the same. In the small speck, you see, the vast wants to realize itself even in this tiny speck. It is a quantitative illusion that we have got. Sri Aurobindo observes somewhere that the Divine is as much present in the huge as in the microscopic. The pressure of consciousness is the same. The quality of consciousness is the same. It is only the illusion of quantity. So the Divine in the vast, He wanted to translate Himself into the microscopic. It comes to the same thing. It is a totally different condition than a natural infinitude. So the most fragmented finiteness, there the Divine wanted to indwell and manifest. Yes.
I would like to know what's the other special experience of
meekness. You see, it's like a knife which cuts both ways. It's significant that is true. Last time when a comet came, in 1960-61 or somewhere there, Mother spoke of a golden being which she met in the comet, who had brought a special substance to be spread out on earth. The golden substance of the supramental world. That's what she said. Now the present comet, when it came, many holy...
Some months ago there was another one, wasn't it?
Yes, anyway, what I am speaking now is the comet that was in November. November, there was a comet. Seeing that, number of people had predicted that spiritually it is not a good sign, that we are in for a difficult, dark period in the spiritual life of the humanity. And I came to know that a few days before the 17th of November, one holy man, when his attention was drawn to the comet, he said, some great spiritual personality is about to pass away. That was a few days before the 19th of November. That person does not know anything about our ashram or mother or anything. After the 17th, or on the 17th or 18th, when again that person was met, and when the tail was visible clearly, he said the person has left. So there can't be a general rule whether these comets are indications of good or bad. We can take it they are indicative of certain significant movements. But usually in Indian astrology, these comets are not very much welcomed.
Signifies a strong change.
Some change. It may be for the good, it may be for the bad. It all depends. Even a bad thing ultimately leaves something good, isn't it? It depends upon how we look at it and with what perspective we look. I believe they are talking at the present of the third, another comet in the papers.
Yes, new comet.
That I do not know anything about it, please.
It will be visible to the naked eye this month, I think, at the end of this month, isn't it?
Same comet, is it?
Same one.
Perhaps it will now do its good part.
What's that?